Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, November 5th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt Grace launches Cannabis Ethics Survey for community input on the future of ethical marijuana. Humboldt Soups punish Bushnell for outburst against staff. Cal Fire proposes forest management plan for Jackson Demonstration State Forest. Critics call it lawless and bogus. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
On November 2nd, Humboldt Grace, a Dreammaker project of the Inc. People Center for the Arts that works to empower rural communities in Humboldt through fundraising and hosting events, announced the Humboldt Grace Cannabis Ethics Survey as part of their ongoing Humboldt Legacy project. KMA News spoke to Lelaney Dubois, the founder of Humboldt Grace, for more information on what the project does.
Humboldt Grace has always been a way to find pathways to help empower that culture that this plant really flourished from. And we define that there's two core values, and that's love and grace. And a lot of people think that's weird from an outlaw culture, but really it's how we managed to navigate for so many years was through respecting each other and, you know, acting with integrity, because if you didn't, bad things happen. And so we've done a few projects in the past. One was we called the Fire Recovery Project, where we raised money to give out ag and building supply vouchers through Daisy Supply Company to not just cannabis farmers, but any landowner or even local nonprofits that were impacted or helped in the fire recovery process. We raised funds for David Watson's memorial last year because we've been doing a project that we call the Humboldt Legacy Project. And the Humboldt Legacy Project is an initiative to really discover ethical pathways to preserve, to authenticate, and give value to the plant and the culture. And we started with genetics. I think to solve any problem, you have to go to the seed, to the core, to the source of the problem. And we saw genetics as really the future for these communities and the industry long game that wasn't being started. In 2022, we published our first white paper around those pathways we saw. And since then, we've been doing a research project around a skunk one that we got documentation back from 11 farms in different regions. We cross-referenced DNA, tested it, and putting it through these ethical standards that we saw as a pathway for the plant. We are at the end of that with the skunk. And when we turned and we looked at the work we did, we realized that really to have a full, holistic, ethical conversation with cannabis, that we needed to talk to the community. We needed to see what the community thought about ethics, because that's where the true foundations of ethics come from.
The Humboldt Legacy Project is a multi-year research initiative launched by Humboldt Grace to gather information on how culture and science can work to protect and authenticate cannabis genetics and heritage. The goal of the ethics survey is to get input from the cannabis community from Humboldt and beyond on the future of ethical cannabis in the legalized era.
It's a very simple survey. It takes about 5 minutes to take. It started out with 48 questions, but we realized we weren't going to conquer this in one pass. And so it's a very simple survey to really see what the cannabis community, and when we say community, we mean all that community. We mean globally that community. We mean members in our own community that don't like cannabis because they were impacted by it. We want to know what you think is ethical. Is the industry ethical? You know, what are some ideas that would help make the industry more ethical? What were some of those core values that kept our system in place for so many generations that could come into the new industry maybe? So they're just some really simple questions that we really hope all of our community will participate in. The results will be published in the white paper, which, as our first one was, will be made for the public. And then they will also be presented in January at the San Diego's Farmers Cup competition. We'll be doing a presentation around our second white paper with the Humboldt Legacy Project and the survey results.
Ethics issues around cannabis cultivation in Humboldt include environmental impact and lack of sustainability practices. There are also social ethical issues as well, like work exploitation and the rapid industrialization of the cannabis industry.
We were gangsters and outlaws and all of that, but what really made the Emerald Triangle so strong and made our roots so strong and made us such a force for so many generations and during political legalization was our back-to-the-land interconnected community roots, which you don't have without integrity. You don't have without accountability, you know? You don't have if you're polarized against each other. When we grew up as kids here, when this really started coming in strong in the early 70s, we relied on the loggers. We relied on law enforcement. We relied on the miners. We relied on the tribes. We all had to teach each other how to do this, you know? We were so isolated. And I don't mean grow weed. I mean how to live in these communities. So I think ethics is a word, a modern word, that defines all of that really clearly.
For more information on the Humboldt Legacy Project and the Cannabis Ethics Survey, the website is humboldtgrace.org. With a second conduct-related complaint filed against Southern Humboldt Supervisor Michelle Bushnell by county staff, the Board of Supervisors has taken action to reprimand her. Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County Supervisor Michelle Bushnell's anger management issues have led to her censure by the Board of Supervisors and loss of her post as chair of the board. Those consequences, stemming from Bushnell's outbursts against county staff last May, were meted out at the board's November 4th meeting. The executive summary of an investigation on it says that Bushnell acted aggressively, yelling and cursing at two county employees and slamming a door. Before discussion on the censure, Bushnell was encouraged to comment, and she acknowledged losing her temper.
I am regretful that the incident that happened the morning, I believe, was of the 5th, made everybody very uncomfortable. I was very loud. I felt wronged, and I reacted bad. I also made staff very uncomfortable. And nobody should have to feel that way in their workplace. Also, I have no issues with the employees in question. They're great employees and do their job. I did apologize, but it was an uncomfortable situation. There are things in my life I have worked hard to overcome, not making excuses at all, but I have a fight or flight personality sometimes. It comes from past traumas of a very abusive relationship. And I work really hard, and I've been in counseling for it for a lot of years. And I sometimes get heated when I feel wronged. And in no way, though, should I ever make an employee feel uncomfortable in their work.
Supervisor Mike Wilson had appreciation for what he described as Bushnell's heartfelt response, but suggested it fell short of recognizing the impacts of her behavior.
Being regretful is something that, and maybe we're not talking in the same way, is sort of an internal space versus, you know, being really sorry about what, you know, you've done is something about that. And then the word uncomfortable. I want to say that when people and when we as in people in power are doing or are behaving in this way, it actually is often perceived as threatening. It's not just uncomfortable. People are concerned about their job, about their livelihoods. They're concerned about their place in the community. So when we are in when we're people in power in those spaces, we're not equal in peers in these situations. So when we behave in this way, it scares people, and it's not just a chilling effect in a working environment. It can be, I dare say, sometimes sort of traumatizing, and maybe not even sort of, maybe actually.
During a public comment period, Bushnell was credited for doing good work by Laura Lassiter of the Southern Humboldt Business and Visitor Bureau and Southern Humboldt cannabis farmer Craig Johnson. But supervisors differentiated between Bushnell's work capability and her conduct with staff, and voted to censure or reprimand her. A follow-up action was consideration of having Bushnell step down as chair of the board, revoke her various committee assignments, and request that the county grand jury look into how the situation has been administrated. Supervisor Steve Madrone noted that the recent blowout, quote, isn't a one-and-done thing, as a previous conduct complaint was filed against her in early 2022, and an investigation found that Bushnell had reacted combatively against county staff. Madrone said at times he's also witnessed Bushnell's disturbing behavior.
You know, like I said, it's not one and done. There was this other incident in 22. Also, I have further witnessed similar behaviors towards staff, the public and community partners at other times. I didn't file formal complaints, but I did witness those personally. And I have a growing, increasing concern over that pattern of bullying, intimidation, and retaliatory conduct, and abusive treatment of others.
The discussion dragged as supervisors got hung up on the bureaucratic aspects of the grand jury process, and it became apparent that Bushnell was struggling to deal with what was happening. Her voice cracking slightly, she said, quote, "Can the board decide what they're going to do now?" But supervisors struggled to come to grips with emotion, and Bushnell called for a vote. She said, quote, "I'm going to tell you guys that I respectfully need to get off this dais," adding, quote, "I respect everybody up here, but I need to breathe." Finally, a majority of supervisors voted to remove Bushnell as chair and refer the messy matter to the grand jury. The vote was 3-1, with Supervisor Rex Bone dissenting. As she had with the previous vote, Bushnell abstained. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Following a series of public comment meetings in regards to drafting a new forest management plan for the Jackson Demonstration State Forest, JDSF, in Mendocino County, CAL FIRE moved to advance a new management plan on October 8th and held more public comment meetings for input. At these meetings, members of the community and ecological groups expressed their concerns about the new management plan directly to CAL FIRE. Recently, the Coalition to Save Jackson State Forest stated in a press release that the management plan being proposed was, quote, "lawless and bogus," end quote, citing that, quote, "CAL FIRE did not complete a tribal co-management plan as required under AB 52 to give tribes whose ancestral land encompasses JDSF an equal, meaningful seat at the table during the planning process," end quote. They also stated that CAL FIRE is not complying with the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, by failing to prepare an environmental impact report, EIR. The last environmental impact report was made in 2007. KMUD News spoke with Alicia Bales, the director for the Redwood chapter of the Sierra Club, which is also part of the Coalition to Save Jackson State Forest, for more information on what's happening.
So CAL FIRE is the agency that manages Jackson, right? And so during the pandemic, they filed a whole bunch of timber harvest plans, and Jackson is like right in the middle of neighborhoods, and particularly in the Casper watershed. There's a bunch of people who live in and around and who are in the forest all the time for, you know, recreation and, you know, mushroom hunting, and, you know, it's part of their lives, right? So this timber harvest plan came down during the pandemic called the Casper 500, which basically like cut down a bunch of really beautiful, large second growth redwoods. And the community sort of rose up to stop the logging and partnered with the Coyote Valley Band of Pomo Indians, who are one of the tribes who it's their ancestral homelands. And so there was a bunch of outcry, and it sort of shut down the logging for a while. And sort of in response to that, I think that's why CAL FIRE did this. CAL FIRE decided to create a new management plan for the forest that, I guess, incorporated concerns of that the community was raising at the time. But they didn't change the mandate of the forest. They didn't change the mandate at the state level, which means that all they can really do is just make some tweaks to the demonstrating commercial logging. They can't change it to reflect, you know, tribal co-management or to reflect, you know, climate-centered management experiments or anything like that. They have to conform with the mandate.
JDSF was opened in 1949 after being purchased by the state in 1942. It was created to study and demonstrate different methods of forest management practices, as well as offer public recreation through hiking trails. After these different logging demonstrations, the lumber that is felled is sold to different mills in California to continue funding the research. Some, like Bales and the Sierra Club, take issue with this practice as well.
So Jackson Demonstration State Forest was set up by the state government in the 1940s to create this sort of like pseudo lab, right, for exploring different methods of industrial logging, right? And they talk about their scientific experiments out there. I don't personally think that what we see out in Jackson is really like to the level of peer-reviewed science. They're certainly doing experiments looking at different forestry methods. And the mandate of Jackson was to demonstrate commercial logging processes, like to be a demonstration of these industrial logging techniques. And so that's what they do. But they also pay for the administration of Jackson Demonstration State Forest through selling logs from their experiments, which is one of, in my opinion, one of the big problems with saying that it's science is that, you know, usually, you know, you're not like selling off the lab rats at the end of your experiment, you know, and having to fund your experiment by selling off the products of your experiment, which is what's happening out at Jackson. So there is really a commercial incentive, in fact, an imperative to make money off of the land, off of the logging. Just those, that setup just needs to change. It's outdated. Nobody needs more demonstration of commercial logging practices. 97% of the redwood ecosystem has been logged. And we're getting into like third and fourth rotations of that logging at this point in the history of colonization. And nobody needs the state logging extra so that we can see how all of that works.
There's one more meeting left for public comment to be made on the new forest management plan, which will be in person on November 10th from 4 to 6 p.m. in Sacramento, though people will be able to submit written comments until December 12th.
I do think that we need to contextualize what's happening in Jackson with the larger effort statewide and nationally to roll back environmental regulations in the name of progress. And so, you know, it's like everywhere we look, the public's voice is being shut out of these important decisions for the public trust, which is what all of our, you know, forests and fisheries and water and all of that. This is, you know, these are public trust values. These are things that we all depend on to survive. So not to mention the non-human world is also, you know, needs to be taken into consideration here, not just the needs of the human world. And so I think that, you know, that's good to keep that in mind. I really encourage people to get involved at the local level, to become active, to speak out, to come to the Jack, whenever they give us an opportunity to come to these public hearings, to come to them, to make sure that they know that we care. It really, really makes a difference. And if people want to join, you know, get involved with the Sierra Club, we're easy to find. You can go to the web and, you know, type in Sierra Club Redwood Chapter, and we have a webpage with a volunteer form.
To find CAL FIRE's forest management plan for JDSF, the website is fire.ca.gov/JDSF plan. For more information about the Coalition to Save Jackson State Forest, the website is savejackson.org. In state news, California groups oppose projects to test hydrogen in natural gas lines, Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Environmental and community groups are speaking out against proposals to raise gas bills across much of California in order to test a blend of hydrogen with natural gas, thus reducing the use of fossil fuels. The utilities, SoCalGas, PG&E, Southwest Gas, and San Diego Gas and Electric, are asking the California Public Utilities Commission to approve a small rate increase to fund pilot projects in Lodi, Orange Cove, Irvine, San Diego, and Truckee. Earth Justice attorney Rebecca Barker represents the Sierra Club and says hydrogen blending just extends the life of gas infrastructure, which contributes to climate change.
Hydrogen blending is a dead-end strategy because at best, it could reduce the CO2 emissions by less than 7%. So if you continue to rely on pipeline gas for those appliances, you would still be generating 93% of the climate pollution of regular natural gas, but your fuel will have become a whole lot more expensive.
Barker says the money would be better spent helping homes and businesses switch to electric appliances powered by renewable energy. She adds that hydrogen could weaken the pipes, raising the risk of leakage or explosions, and could increase indoor air pollution. SoCalGas, on its website, says hydrogen blending supports the state's climate and clean air goals and has been used safely in Hawaii. Barker notes that these are the first hydrogen blending projects to be considered by the California Public Utilities Commission.
There have been a handful of pilot projects around the world that have tried to explore whether hydrogen blending could be possible without weakening the gas utilities systems. And we have never seen a pilot that convinced regulators who were responsible for protecting consumers that anyone should be paying extra money for a hydrogen blend.
The pilot program in the tiny farmworker town of Orange Cove would test the hydrogen methane blend in the gas lines of 10,000 customers. City leaders have welcomed the project, citing revenue from leasing land to SoCalGas. Attorney Michael Claiborne with Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability represents a local opposition group called Orange Cove United.
Folks we've talked to in Orange Cove are most concerned about health risks associated with burning hydrogen indoors and damage to appliances that were not designed to burn hydrogen.
A review of 54 studies on hydrogen heating in the journal Cell Reports Sustainability concluded that hydrogen is less efficient and more costly than using electricity to power buildings and homes. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, government shutdown now tied for longest ever at 35 days. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The federal government shutdown hit a milestone Tuesday as the partisan stalemate continues. Republican John Thune is the Senate Majority Leader.
We are now in the 35th day of the shutdown, the longest shutdown on record and the most severe shutdown on record, something that was totally unnecessary in the first place, obviously, but we're hoping this will be the week when the Democrats come to their senses and decide to reopen the government.
Democrats, of course, take a different view. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries said Tuesday's elections will show Americans reject the Republican position as the shutdown continues.
There's nothing to be optimistic about because of what Trump and Republicans have done to this country. They've gone way too far, and the American people know it, and the results today are going to decisively reflect that fact.
The leader's remarks come amid some signs of a possible compromise in the deadlock, with some senators quietly negotiating an end to the shutdown. The standoff centers on Democratic demands to prevent Affordable Care Act price hikes that could throw millions of people out of their health insurance. Jeffries is hopeful the Senate will move forward with an Affordable Care Act resolution.
And now we're seeing movement in the Senate, because apparently Senate Republicans recognize that something needs to happen as it relates to extending the Affordable Care Act tax credit. So we'll evaluate any agreement, if an agreement is presented to us, as a caucus, but not before that.
The interruption of SNAP food aid for low-income families has ramped up pressure for an agreement to reopen the government. On Friday, two federal judges ordered the Trump administration to continue the food program. The Trump administration agreed to fund about half of what's needed for November, and it will take a while for even that money to reach hungry people. On Tuesday, President Trump threatened in a Truth Social post that he would halt the SNAP aid until, in his words, the radical left Democrats open up government. Trump's press secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, later clarified.
The administration is fully complying with the court order. I just spoke to the president about it. The recipients of these SNAP benefits need to understand it's going to take some time to receive this money because the Democrats have forced the administration into a very untenable position. We are digging into a contingency fund that is supposed to be for emergencies, catastrophes, for war. And the president does not want to have to tap into this fund in the future. And that's what he was referring to in his Truth Social post.
With the House of Representatives in recess, any real action on the shutdown will be taking place in the Senate. Perhaps in the White House also, though so far, President Trump has not been forthcoming about negotiating with Democrats. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump wants the Defense Department to resume nuclear weapons testing immediately. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio reports, that's sending shockwaves around the West.
Prior to a moratorium imposed by Congress in 1992, the U.S. conducted over 1,000 nuclear tests, mostly done at the Nevada test site, even hundreds of above-ground detonations.
We can't fully rule it out. That would be extremely provocative.
Daryl Kimball is executive director of the Nonpartisan Arms Control Association.
I don't think people need to fear mushroom clouds on the desert floor outside of Las Vegas, but the very notion of resuming nuclear testing, in my view, is a disrespectful slap in the face to those who in the past have suffered from radiation poisoning from nuclear testing fallouts in the Mountain West.
Like Leslie Begay, a former Navajo uranium miner. He's also a Vietnam vet and cancer survivor, having a double lung transplant with 123 stitches in all.
That was the hardest thing I ever encountered. These are some of the things that people are going to go through.
Compensation for radiation exposure victims was revived this summer. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
Residents of St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea have traditionally subsisted on walrus, whales, and fish. But availability of marine resources has been changing, and reindeer have become a staple. Now, Savunga is almost done building a meat processing facility that can turn it into a business. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Richmond Tooley rides his four-wheeler across the wet tundra outside of Savunga. The mountains of black volcanic rock glisten behind him in the September sun, and the Bering Sea in front. Tooley is a third-generation chief reindeer herder. He pauses to spot the animals through his binoculars.
All summer there are reindeer out here.
St. Lawrence Island sits 100 miles west from mainland Alaska, with two villages on it, Savunga and Gamble. It's also home to several thousand free-range reindeer. In the late 1800s, famine struck the island, and the animals were introduced here as a food source. Today, the herd continues to support the island as warming conditions disrupt subsistence, and storms can hold up food deliveries for weeks. Now, Savunga is building a reindeer meat processing facility. Freeman Kinnicook is the business director of the Savunga Reindeer Commercial Company, a subsidiary of the village that will manage the facility. He says the plan is to slaughter reindeer about four times a year and sell it locally. In the future, there might be a chance to distribute it to other Alaska villages as well.
When we did those trial runs, we would sell on Facebook, and we couldn't keep up with the demand. It's undecided who the market is, but I know there's a market for it.
Perry Idiganak Pangowi is a subsistence hunter and one of the locals working on a project. Pangowi says the new facility already brought a much-needed influx of jobs to the village and might open new economic opportunities.
It would be nice to have our stores selling our local reindeer because it's hard to afford that steak. It's like $50, $60 for a piece of steak. And to me, reindeer tastes a lot better than steak.
Construction is scheduled to be completed in the coming weeks. With reporting from Savunga, I am Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.